Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's call to address worker safety crisis at meatpacking plants. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Maria Elena Incolpie. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Maria Elena Incolpie, and I am the Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center. We're so grateful to be here today to discuss the urgent needs for workplace protections and economic relief for meatpacking workers through federal and state policy, as well as employer accountability. I'm honored to join our state partners from the National Immigration Law Center's Winning in the States initiative, two incredible leaders in our country, Christine Newman Ortiz from Voces de la Frontera in Wisconsin, and Stephanie Teatro from the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. Both of them have been leading their organizations in extensive work over the years to fight for the dignity and rights of all immigrants and their communities. I'm also especially honored to have three other courageous speakers on this call today, Dora Flores and her father, Guadalupe Paez, who both work at the same meatpacking plant in Wisconsin and have been personally impacted with COVID-19, and Alejandra Murguia Ortiz, who has led an incredible organizing effort among meatpacking workers and their families in Iowa. Guadalupe, Dora, and Alejandro, thank you for your bravery and your leadership in sharing your story today so that the country understands what the realities you are facing are. We're grateful to have you with us and to be in this fight along your side. Courageous workers across the country are sounding the alarm because they're afraid for their safety and that of their families, and they do so at great risk of retaliation by their employers and by immigration enforcement. When immigrant status is a factor, workers don't have the security that they need to be able to openly speak out against injustice. It's a shameful reality that plays out in so many workplaces across the country and impacts all workers' ability to thrive. This applies to all workers, but especially to immigrants whose ability to exercise their workers' rights is even more precarious than their U.S.-born workers, co-workers. And right now, immigrants make up a significant percentage of people that are providing critical services during this pandemic, and they make up over half of all meatpacking workers. In recent days, we've seen media attention focusing on small groups of armed protesters who are banging on doors at state capitals to demand non-essential businesses open for them. This is immoral and unjust and endangers our collective well-being. This pandemic has exposed the historical racial inequities in our health, immigration, and labor and employment system, which means that immigrants and other workers of color are impacted by COVID-19 at a greater scale. We must listen first and foremost to the concerns and demands of these workers, like the ones who are presenting today on this call, who are literally keeping this country running through their essential work and whose health and safety is vital to us recovering from this public health crisis. We cannot and will not turn a blind eye to their need for safe and just working conditions. That's why we have come here together today as advocates for worker justice, along with empowered workers who are speaking out and demanding real solutions to ensure the safety and well-being of all workers. Meatpacking plants have long been places where workers have endured grueling and hazardous conditions at the hands of corporations that have put profit over people, and a government that perpetuates this harm instead of intervening. Especially now during the crisis, government and employer inaction is having needlessly cruel and devastating consequences on the lives of workers and their families. And in turn, this will have an impact on our food supply and overall health. NBC has recently reported that more than 6,500 workers in the meatpacking industry have tested positive for the coronavirus and over 30 have died. Many of these deaths could have been prevented if employers had been willing to make the operational changes necessary to protect their employees. Just as people working in essential industries are making it possible for all of us to feed our families, workers also have families to feed and care for. Yet we continue to hear stories about workers who are going without paid sick leave, being incentivized to not take days off, and therefore showing up to work sick. Workers have the right to be safe and healthy when reporting to work each day, not just during the crisis. When deprived of these rights, it affects everyone in the workplace, as we're seeing now. It can have consequences to our supply chain and throughout the communities where meatpacking workers live. If we don't address our concerns, we won't have a workforce. We cannot think of healthy employees and a resilient supply chain as two separate issues. It is only when workers are safe, healthy, and able to live and work with dignity that our supply chain can be strong and healthy. The government must set universal worksite health and safety standards. Congress should require OSHA to issue an emergency standard requiring employers to take certain steps to protect these workers. And in the absence of federal action, states and localities should also step in and ensure that the workplaces in their state are not unnecessarily putting people at risk of exposure. We at the National Immigration Law Center are committed to continuing to fight alongside these workers to demand that they receive access to health care, to COVID-19 testing, treatment, and care, regardless of economic or immigration status, and also that they receive the economic relief and protections in the workplace. In addition to workplace policies, we must also look at the divisive policies such as public charge, Trump's wealth test, to understand why so many immigrants are afraid of seeking COVID-19 testing or treatment. No one in this country should be sick or die because they're afraid of being punished for seeing a doctor. And no worker should have to consider reporting to work through illness because they know that they won't be able to support their families if they take unpaid sick leave. Or worse, if they're afraid to lose their jobs if they miss work due to being sick. Confronting this crisis means coming to terms with the ways that we have failed to build strong, inclusive structures that support the needs of everyone who calls this country home. With that, I am honored to turn this call over to Christine Numenortiz, who will speak to what her organization is experiencing on the ground in Wisconsin, and will also be interpreting for Guadalupe Páez and for his daughter, Dora Flores, who will actually be the first speaker. Christine and Dora?
Thank you so much, Maria Elena. It's a real honor to introduce now Dora Flores, who is the daughter of Guadalupe Páez. Guadalupe has worked at the company there for 14 years, and his daughter has been speaking on his behalf while he was in critical care. And it's a real treat because they can both be here for the first time as part of a public press conference to speak together because they've been in the struggle together, even as she has been in quarantine and he has been in critical condition at the hospital. So, Dora, adelante, por favor. Dora, no sé si estás en silencio.
Operator Gina, Dora's line is muted.
Sorry, se cortó.
No, está bien.
Tranquila.
¿Ya puedo hablar?
Sí, adelante.
Hola, buenas tardes a todos. Mi nombre es Dora Flores.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dora Flores.
Soy una de las familias que fue afectada por el COVID-19.
I am one of the families that was affected by COVID-19.
Mi papá trabaja en JBS Packerman. Hace ya 15 años que trabaja allí.
My father works at JBS Packerland, and it's been close to 15 years now.
Mi papá se había sentido mal ya durante varios días. En el trabajo, pero en el trabajo no le hicieron caso.
My father had been feeling sick for many days, but they ignored him.
Otra de las razones del por qué él agarró el virus ahí en la compañía fue porque la compañía no estaba teniendo las precauciones necesarias para los empleados.
The main reason he got COVID-19 at work is because the company was not implementing the safety precautions they needed to protect workers.
El día 12 de abril, mi papá estuvo bien enfermo y lo tuve que llevar al hospital de emergencia.
My father became very sick on April 12th and I had to take him to the hospital for the emergency room.
Mientras esperábamos en el hospital, él estaba, le hicieron el test y nos dijeron que él tenía el virus.
While we waited at the hospital, then they gave us the results and he was positive with the virus.
Mientras nosotros estábamos esperando pues, los resultados, estaba hablando yo con mi papá de que teníamos que decirle a la gente que él tenía el virus.
I spoke with my father and he told me that we did have to let people know that he had been positive with the virus.
Porque en la compañía no le estaban dando información a las personas de quién estaban enfermos y quiénes estaban saludables.
Because the company was not letting other workers know at the plant who was infected.
So lo que nosotros decidimos es que hablamos a nuestras amistades para que supieran que mi papá tenía el virus y ellos tomaran las precauciones necesarias.
So we made that decision and then spoke to all of the people that we knew so they could take the proper precautions.
So cuando nos dijeron que él tenía el virus en el ese día, me dijeron que yo me tenía que retirar del hospital, que él se tenía que quedar internado.
So then they told me he had to stay at the hospital and I had to leave and that he had to remain there.
Ya que mi papá tenía una fuerte neumonía, tenían que tratársela.
And he had a very strong pneumonia and he had to be treated.
So desde ese momento mi familia pasó por situaciones bien difíciles ya que él estuvo en situación crítica en el hospital.
That was a very difficult time for myself and my family because he passed through a very serious health crisis.
Gracias, pero gracias a Dios, él está bien ya.
But thanks to God, he is now fine.
Ahorita yo doy gracias a Voces de la Frontera porque gracias a ellos nosotros alzamos la voz como familia y como con otros trabajadores también porque ya que la compañía no estaba haciendo caso a las peticiones que estaban haciendo los trabajadores.
And we're grateful for Voces' role in helping us raise our voice and our concerns for our family and our coworkers and their families as well because the company was ignoring us.
También pues debo decirte también le debo dar gracias a Voces de la Frontera por toda la ayuda que nos han dado y por todo el asesoramiento que nos han dado.
And we're very grateful because it gave us, you know, very critical information.
Pero también a hoy mismo puedo decir que estoy contenta ya que toda mi familia está completa porque tenemos aquí a mi papá en casa. Está todavía débil, pero está en casa y con nosotros.
And I can tell you that we're very happy right now because our family is complete and we are reunited. And even though he is weak, we are all together in the same home again.
Y pues puedo decir que mi papá puede hablar con ustedes ahorita y se los puedo pasar.
And so I'm now going to pass you to my father.
¿Puedo hablar ya?
Sí, está bien, don Fayez.
Oh, sí. Pues aquí estoy en mi casa, gracias a Dios, con toda mi familia.
Here I am at home with all of my family.
Y pues le doy gracias a Dios. Y quiero decir...
And thanks to God.
Quiero darles gracias a ustedes también por el resto que nos están dando, ¿verdad?, en la teoría, para que haya, como ustedes están haciendo algo con la gente que trabaja en la página.
And I'm so grateful for, like, the help that we have received for all of the workers here at Packerland.
Y quiero decir a los compañeros de trabajo que tenemos dónde irnos, poner nuestras quejas también, que no los dejen del trabajo.
And that it's also a message to my coworkers, worker and other workers that that we have to raise our voices so that our concerns are heard.
Yo pienso que tenemos nuestros derechos también de hablar, pero hay mucha gente que se queda callada, no sé por qué. Nosotros tenemos nuestros derechos.
And I believe that we do have a right to speak out, and there are many people who remain silent. But that we have the right to speak out. And I'm also angry for how I was treated. They did not. ¿Quieres agregar la última parte?
Okay, yo me siento un poco enojado por lo que me hicieron, que no creían que yo estaba enfermo.
Because they did not want to believe that I was sick. They just told me, you just have a cold.
Un mensaje que quiera que diga a los compañeros de trabajo.
¿Y qué sería tu mensaje?
Pues que primero es la vida que el trabajo.
My message to the workers would be, above work is your life. Thank you so much. Muchísimas gracias, Don Baez y Dora. And it really is a special celebration today because this is the first time that Don Baez is able to be with his daughter, who is speaking out so much on his and her family, the family's behalf. I just want to add that one of the great accomplishments, Dora, who was coordinating with her father, was able to be one of the first two workers at the meatpacking plants. Herself and Raquel Alvarado from American Foods were the first two workers in this essential worker rights organizing that we have been doing since mid-April. They were the first two to really give voice to what was happening. And out of a result of that, we, and frankly with support also from Milk in terms of some guidance on this, we were able to file complaints on the workers' behalf with OSHA, with the health department at the state level, and bring this to the attention to different state and local government bodies, and bring it to the attention of the public as well. And this, you know, support for what the workers were already asking for has been our strategy. And in this case, it's a wonderful example of what can be accomplished, because not only are we celebrating the fact that Don Baez and his family are reunited today, survived this, but because of their courage, right now in both of these companies, all of their demands, the workers' demands, have been met, which is, you know, at American Foods now, they have masks, they have 6 feet distancing, they have people have been tested. From what was initially something that was in the dark as of May 1st, 290 workers at American Foods have tested positive, 203 at American Foods, and JBS Packerland, which came out the same time in Green Bay as well, is 290. So this was something that if it hadn't been for the intervention, you know, if it hadn't been for these workers insisting on their dignity of themselves, that their lives have value, and the support that they received here in Wisconsin and through support nationally with, you know, that we ourselves received, that it has been everything that was asked for has been accomplished. Paid sick days has been accomplished as well. And the only thing that I'll add is that this strategy we have used, and we've had 9 companies that workers that have approached us in 9 different companies. The bulk of that is meatpacking and food production, the vast majority. And what we have seen important, and this is specific to American Foods, is that you can't just have these make this progress without it continuing. There has to be constant communication with workers. Workers need to maintain that kind of support, internal support within the company. In the case of American Foods, a perfect example is that there was a worker there who, once the masks were achieved, was in a production line, and they were, so there were fewer people, they were trying to work them as hard as if more people were there. It was causing the masks to a lot of sweat and hard breathing, and the mask was, you know, starting to, like, fall apart, not be, you know, not provide protection. And they had obviously rightful concerns about the quality of the protection. And for that, one of those workers was retaliated against and right now has a complaint that we have filed on his behalf. But these are examples of the constant vigilance that is required to do the follow-through with these OSHA complaints where OSHA can't even come in to do an inspection. So they depend on these workers, on the outside support to communicate and to have this kind of public pressure, governmental agency support to fundamentally value the lives of these workers and their families, essential workers and their families. And so with that, I'll conclude and just say that, you know, we obviously are shoulder to shoulder on the demands that are being made that Maria Elena addressed at the beginning. These should not be optional guidelines. These should be mandatory guidelines. And there really should be demands around higher quality masks and improvement around these essential worker industries before we even talk about let's put everybody back to work. It's madness, and essential workers need our support right now in real time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christine, and thank you for your leadership and all that you and your workers and members have been able to achieve so far. And we know that the fight is a long one, and especially a recognition for Mr. Guadalupe Páez and his daughter, Dora, for being with us today. I'm so happy that you are both healthy and that your families are better. But most importantly, thank you also for being so courageous and fighting not just for yourself, but all the other workers relying on you. As Christine said, oftentimes workers are actually acting as private attorney generals to ensure that employers are being held accountable. Our next speaker is Alejandro Murguia Ortiz, who is an organizer and I believe a child of meatpacking workers who has been organizing in Iowa. So, Alejandro?
And thank you for having me, and thank you to Dora and your family. Gracias, Dora y familia, for sharing your stories. You know, it's really encouraging to see some families, you know, have the courage to speak up. And I'll be talking a little bit about, you know, kind of what we're seeing as it very much mirrors. So, you know, the stories that we're hearing, and it's really across the state. It's industry-wide, these practices, these injustices. It's really across the board. So, you know, really working towards, again, you know, as Lavelle mentioned, you know, long-term efforts to continue this dialogue and joint efforts across state lines, just because there really does need to be kind of a bigger picture goal and efforts and collaboration there. But a little bit more about, you know, specifically what I've been seeing. So I'm from Sioux City, Iowa. That's the tri-state area there of South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa. Very heavily populated with, well, there's several food processing plants there, largely meat packing plants. So very, you know, immigrant heavy population there. Very much, you know, a lot of the immigrant population there has family that works there, specifically with me. That industry, those jobs, that's why I'm in Iowa. Not just my parents, but my extended family. I have aunts, uncles, cousins, whom either at some point were here, worked there, or continue to do so. And, you know, that's the same for many of my friends growing up. That's essentially what our life was, you know, very much, you know, it's a community. It's a lot of people you know, again, that are working in different plants, you know, some couples, some parents, one working at one plant, one at another, which is, you know, kind of what my situation is. So there is very much, you know, again, these conversations and understanding that these practices are happening in all of these plants. So what, you know, initially happened, you know, we were having these conversations with our parents about what was going on in the plants, and you know, we were saying that not only were they scared, but, you know, of course we were scared. We were scared for them. Many of our parents are older. Both of my parents are around 60, have health concerns. You know, they've had health problems, and many of which have, you know, been exacerbated by this work. You know, it's very hard work. These are individuals that are standing for hours at a time, and in many of these places they have forced weekends, doing very repetitive work, and many times very fast speeds these lines are moving. So, you know, as has been said, is that, you know, some of these issues that we're seeing are, you know, a lot of them, most of them, they're just kind of coming to the surface as they affect pretty much every employee in these plants. But these practices, these, you know, how the companies have been so secretive about stuff, just the sense that, you know, this feeling that workers have, this fear of retaliation, of, you know, if they address concerns, you know, they're not going to have an honest response from the employers. And these things have just kind of stacked on to continue to instill fear in these workers and fear to not speak up, as Dora and her family have, to, you know, continue to stay silent because they do, you know, to some extent, understandably, prioritize their, you know, their livelihoods of, you know, being able to, I guess, have a job and you know, support their families is, you know, very important, and some are willing to risk their lives to do so. So it's, you know, this fear that, you know, our parents have shared with us that really instilled this desire to really speak up, and, you know, and it came down to creating a community, which is what I was able to do, of, you know, just the children of these workers. Many of us, you know, we're born here. This is our home, and, you know, we've had some privileges that our parents haven't had, and we want to be able to use those to you know, bring this awareness and to do what we can to create really that support, and that you know, to hold these companies accountable, and again to continue to build that community support so that more workers do have that confidence to, you know, be the ones telling their story, to be able to feel confident that, you know, they're going to be able to go into work, and it's going to be safe, that there are, that, you know, OSHA or whomever are able to actually, you know, enforce these safety guidelines. Because again, you know, they're very hard workers. They have worked incredibly hard for decades, you know, just to provide for us, and to, you know, the reason that they aren't going in, you know, that these plants are down so many employees, is because they want to be able to do it safely. And, you know, they, you know, these companies, as has been stated, have been very secretive about numbers, about whom around them has had it. You know, people, you know, they find out who that, you know, they're neighbor, the person that works next to them has it, and they're not being told. Right now, for instance, people are waiting days on end to even have a simple communication from their employers to, you know, to hear back about the results or what's expected of them, and really even, you know, whether or not they're going to get paid. And a lot of workers are out of work either, you know, because they're scared, and, you know, they're not able to, you know, to get an income, and even some people who tested positive aren't getting paid. And it's just, again, just kind of stems back to these systemic issues that exist in these plants that continue to, you know, to eliminate any voice that these workers have. And so, you know, what we're building, what we're trying to do is to find a you know, direct communication to these workers. So, you know, we who, you know, may have some resources or who can build a network of other allies to address these concerns can really start to work together, and, you know, we can hopefully expand these efforts to, you know, work again across state lines, as given this specific community in Siouxland that is, you know, it's a tri-state area. I mean, that truly does require, you know, that, you know, those cross-state collaboration to truly, you know, get people the resources that they need. Because that's, again, another barrier that a lot of these workers face is the communication of resources, of information, even, you know, just simply what, you know, the virus itself, and being able to communicate that to your employees is definitely something that we haven't seen. I mean, it's a very diverse area, very diverse industry. So many languages are spoken, and, you know, we have to be able to provide these workers with all of the resources that they need. And most importantly, I think what we're trying to do is really build on the trust of these workers. Because at the end of the day, we have to be talking directly to them, and we have to be able to be asking them what it is that they need, you know, what we can do to help them to truly, you know, change and tackle this as a long-term issue, as opposed to just be putting Band-Aids and, you know, coming up with simply short-term solutions that, you know, these plants may abandon in a few months even. So that's essentially what our mission has been, is to continue that dialogue and, you know, build an allyship and find resources, and then, you know, truly find a way to communicate that directly to the workers themselves, and hope we can build that confidence in them to, you know, start sharing their stories and have that support from the community. If we do see that retaliation, we can start to hold them accountable for that.
Great. Thank you so much, Alejandro, and thank you for your leadership and all the organizing and advocacy that you're doing, and also for reminding us that for many of these workers, they're not, if they lose their job or they're not getting paid, they're not eligible, many of them, for any of the federal stimulus packages and unemployment insurance that's being provided to other workers. And so, again, the livelihood and a mere ability to survive and to support their own families at the same time that they're working to make sure that we are all being fed is part of the crisis that we're experiencing, and that this isn't new, right? That this is systemic and historic as well. Yeah, so thank you for that. Our next and final speaker is Stephanie Teatro, who is the director of the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, who also will be speaking about the incredible work that they've been doing in Tennessee. Stephanie?
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, long before the COVID-19 pandemic, meatpacking, of course, has been one of the most dangerous jobs in America. And for us, the last time that meat processing plants here in Tennessee made headlines was a little more than 2 years ago, when the Trump administration conducted its first massive worksite raid at a plant outside of Morristown in East Tennessee. At the time, it was the largest worksite immigration raid in nearly a decade. But of course, since then, the Trump administration has only escalated their use of worksite raids. And it was at food processing plants across Mississippi where ICE arrested more than 680 people last year. And so in the aftermath of the raid in East Tennessee, dozens of very serious health and safety violations were brought to light. For many years, workers had gone to work in extraordinarily dangerous conditions. And we know that when employers and the government can hold the threat of deportation above workers' heads, or when workers fear losing their jobs and income if they speak up, they're less likely to report dangerous conditions like these. And so now we once again turn to these dangerous conditions that workers are facing in meat processing plants, this time amid a pandemic. So here in Tennessee, we're seeing the same horrifying trend that's emerging across the country, where meat processing plants are becoming hotspots for COVID outbreaks. In Goodlettsville, a community that's right outside of Nashville, there are now nearly 300 workers who have tested positive for COVID at a single food processing plant. Another in Shelbyville, just south of Nashville, recently closed for several days after an outbreak there. So starting several weeks ago, we began fielding calls from workers in food processing plants across the state who have been terrified to go to work and wondering what could be done. There had been rumors of coworkers testing positive. Many people had stopped showing up for their shifts, but no one was sure if people weren't at work because they were sick or because they were scared. So workers were left wondering if they had worked next to someone who had been infected and maybe they'd been exposed and in turn infected their families, but they were told nothing by their employers. If people feared that they had been exposed, they were unlikely to take time off to self-isolate just in case. They couldn't afford it and didn't have access to paid leave. And many of those who have tested positive are experiencing extraordinary financial hardship for missing several weeks of work. Many of the workers that I spoke with had very clear ideas of what kind of mitigation could be done to make workers feel more safe and to slow the spread of infection. But they were terrified to bring it up to their bosses or didn't feel like their concerns were heard and they didn't know where to turn. They were afraid to lose their job and lose their income if they spoke up. And we see the outbreak that's happening in food processing plants across the country as a real canary in the coal mine. The federal government has failed to provide sufficient protections to workers. We clearly cannot just rely on businesses to implement the voluntary guidelines from the federal government that are necessary to keep workers, their families, and our whole community safe. Tennessee is one of those states that's already beginning to reopen our economy, expanding the numbers of Tennesseans who will be going to work while public health officials continue their work to stop the spread of COVID. But you cannot flatten the curve without improving working conditions. Like the federal government, our state has only issued guidelines for how businesses can protect their employees. But to keep Tennesseans safe and to slow the spread of COVID, our state and local governments and our federal government must ensure that all employers are implementing the guidance of OSHA and public health experts on how to keep employees safe at work. These expanded health and safety protections must go hand in hand with clear mechanisms to ensure that employers are complying and employees who feel unsafe have recourse. In addition to keeping their workplaces safe, we must also ensure that workers who are infected with COVID or who must care for family members who have been infected are able to take paid leave to recover or provide care without risking infecting their coworkers. Now more than ever, it is abundantly clear that our health and well-being are interdependent with our neighbors and our coworkers. And this means that no worker should have to put themselves at risk of getting ill in order to provide for their family. Workers in the food processing industries have always been essential. Those who went to work at the plant in Morristown that was violently raided by ICE agents, and those who are going to work today, risking infection to keep a roof over their heads. We must ensure that all workers, no matter where they're from or how they got here, are protected and safe at work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you to each of our speakers. Operator, if you can please give instructions for the Q&A.
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And once again, to ask a question today, that is star and one. And we will pause a moment to allow for questions to queue. And once more for your questions today, that is star and one. We'll pause another moment.
And as we wait for questions, as several of our speakers have talked about, right, this is the challenges that workers are facing right now are systemic and historic and have existed for years and decades, even before the current COVID-19 crisis. And the fact is that the call that these workers are doing is helping to expose and bring attention to conditions that are deplorable and cannot continue to exist. As consumers, as advocates of justice, as average Americans who are eating poultry, eating meat, eating fruits, eating vegetables, who rely on workers like Guadalupe Endora and Alejandro and his family, we cannot allow for these conditions to continue. And so this is a reminder, again, that this public health crisis has exposed the fractures, pre-existing fractures and systemic inequalities in our society, but also that we are so interdependent and reliant on each other. Our collective health and well-being is dependent on each other. Operator, do we have any questions lined up?
We'll move to our first question from Justin Sadowski with Up North News. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, perfect. This is aimed at mostly the folks with Voces de la Frontera. GBS Packerland reopened today, and there's still a lot of secrecy around it. You know, we don't know the current numbers. We're not really sure on what the conditions are like in the plant. So I was wondering, either Dora or Guadalupe or Christine, if you've heard anything about what it is like now that the plant has reopened.
So Dora y Don Paez, lo que estaba preguntando era que la compañía JBS Packerland ahora va a reabrir, y si han escuchado sobre los números, las condiciones. Mm-hmm. I mean, yo puedo responder también, pero si quieren responder primero.
Pues lo que único que escuché de una amiga es que no fue mucha gente a trabajar hoy, que muchísima gente no se reportó a trabajar, pero en las condiciones de adentro de la compañía, yo creo que voy a saber hasta más al rato ya cuando mis compañeros o mis amigos me digan.
So I heard from... Adelante, perdón.
Porque abrió a hoy la matanza, la área donde trabaja mi papá. Este, a hoy abrió, pero mañana va a abrir a la área del Boni.
Mm-hmm. So I from the conversations I've had with some of my friends, they say that not too many people went to work today, that they're opening them up in stages. So the slaughterhouse where my father works was opened, and the boning section is going to be opening. So that's an area where I know more people, so I'll be able to have more information about that. I know that, I guess the one thing that I would add, and certainly feel free, Dora, to chime in here, is that before the company closed because of the, I think, you know, just the intervention where there was, which required all of these, brought attention to these demands, and a big one being testing is where, you know, it was very clear that just the scale of the problem was so great. I mean, as of May 1st, through the county that collects all the health department that collects all the data, we do know that at JBS, it's 290 cases, and so, you know, they were representing, it's right now Brown County is a huge part of the cases, and a big part of that is the meatpacking plant, these two meatpacking plants. You know, we do know that from the OSHA inspection and from corroborating that with workers inside the plant, that the changes were being implemented before they basically were forced to shut down. Big part of what we have seen in these shutdowns recently, not just here but in other places, has been that part of the reason that you do get the physical distancing, you're able kind of to win that fight on the physical distancing or even a forced shutdown, is that people are really afraid that the problem got so out of hand that you're forced to make a choice between your life and this job, and that workers are, you know, because they see what's happening, and as in the case with Don Baez, whose life was in play, you know, people are afraid. So the companies have to really win the confidence back of the workers that they are disinfecting, and that they, after positive cases, and are strongly implementing these guidelines if they want to operate. In a sense, what we've seen have been a lot of the workers themselves, not the companies, but the workers, resulting in these shutdowns because of the loss of confidence.
Oh, Mary, thank you for that. Operator, is there any other questions?
Absolutely. And as a friendly reminder to ask your questions today, that is star and one. We'll move next to Dulce Torres from Tennessee Lookout. Please go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to know if there have been able to figure out how many people have become infected here in Tennessee due to hazardous work conditions, and how has the government responded in addressing these issues?
Yeah, so the number I shared, I think it came out yesterday from the Goodlitz cell plant in Tyson. I think the most recent numbers the health department, the local health department gave was 298 confirmed cases, which is a pretty significant increase from the last time they were reported. And the government agency that's been responding has been the local health department, and we'll say we can follow up more online, more offline, but they have determined at this point that that the company is taking proper mitigation measures, and so the company or the plant remains in operation. But I would just echo what Christine said about both the confidence of the workers, and not only in terms of people feeling safe going back to work, but also we can't wait until at plants across Tennessee for these numbers to increase as high as they have, and for the public pressure to focus on these plants, that we need to make sure that workers have the ability to raise their concerns early on so that there can be mitigation efforts well in advance of any outbreak.
Right. Thank you.
Our next question from Stephen Wishnia from Labor Press. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for answering. Which of these plants, if any, are unionized, or are the majority non-union? And can you tell me, are there any specific ways in which employers have retaliated against workers who spoke out, or is it more just, you know, people feel that if I open my mouth, I'm going to get fired, or they're going to call immigration, or both?
Great questions. Christine, can we start with you and Dora and Don Pais first? And then Alejandro would love to hear your perspective as well.
La pregunta era si el temor de por el estatus inmigratorio de trabajadores en las empacadoras es una razón que la gente tiene miedo de hablar y dar a conocer sus necesidades.
Y también si cualquiera de las plantas son tienen sindicato.
Lo que yo tengo entendido que JBS sí tiene el sindicato, pero el American Food no. Y otra de las cosas de que muchas de las personas van a trabajar porque como que los esfuerzan a que trabajen, a que digan, okay, tienes que trabajar todo este mes y te vamos a dar bonos, porque le están queriendo pagar bonos extras a la gente solamente aunque estén enfermas para que puedan ir a trabajar.
Y sobre inmigración, no sé si tienen alguna reflexión sobre eso.
No, porque pues ahorita que nosotros empezamos a estar hablando sobre los derechos de los trabajadores, yo creo que mucha gente ha decidido el no ir al trabajo, ya más por la salud, no por tanto por el dinero.
And so the JBS does have a union, American Foods does not. The gravest issue has really been that many people are going to work because the company has policies to like incentivize going to work even if you're sick. For example, giving a bonus if you don't miss a day in a month, and so to incentivize people going sick. But now, because we have been speaking up, the main response of people choosing not to go to work. And then maybe if I could just add something to that, because yes, Voces worked so much with immigrant workers over so many, last 20 years now, mm-hmm. and I would say this time that we're in, this pandemic period, is very unique in that I think the fact that the COVID-19 virus is so potentially lethal to either the worker or their families, and that this is something that it's, what I've seen is that, you know, like as in this case of workers choosing not to go to work, it is a form of, has been a form of resistance, and people have been coming, you know, do need outside support, but have been raising their voices and their concerns as what they're seeing happen around them with these rashes of people getting it because of the lack of protections and seeing fundamental questions about their dignity, about the dignity of their lives for themselves and their families, which surpasses surpasses anything that has to do with immigration status, anything that has to do with the law, anything that has to do with your paycheck, because it's that fundamental. It's a life and death struggle that's in play here, and that's not your typical situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just feel that it's a unique moment in that the leadership that is being shown by these workers coming forward is critical. And I do think that on issues, for example, it's so critical that these paid sick days are a part of this, and we take away policies that are encouraging people to come to work sick are very much a critical component of this, especially in these large companies that have the money and are not being legally required to pay these workers, even if they're sick. And because of the pressure, this is happening, but it's still a fight, and not in all companies are they doing it. And if you are an immigrant worker, you can't qualify for unemployment. Your access to health care is limited. And so that's another reason why we do need the companies to step up, and we need the government to step up to support essential workers, and including immigrant essential workers.
Thank you for that, Christine. Alejandro, do you want to add from your perspective, again, the questions about concerns about retaliation due to immigration status and whether any of the plants in Iowa are union?
Right.
And then we're going to wrap up.
And definitely, you know, in terms of like unions and such, it's kind of a mixed bag just here in the Solana area and across the state where, you know, Tyson here in Dakota City, Nebraska, which is around here in Sioux City, is unionized. However, Smithfield is not, and even some of the Tysons across the state are and others aren't. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but unfortunately we're still seeing the same or very similar outcomes in these different plants where what we're hearing from workers and regards to the unions is that they even the unions themselves have expressed being powerless. And even with some of the conversations that I've had, it's when they have whether that was before this happened or throughout this time, addressed concerns or said, hey, maybe the company should be doing this. There's even been pushback, potentially even from the union leaders, of saying like, "Well, let's not start something here with the company." Or so I don't know specifically. I don't know if I've had the opportunity to speak with enough union reps to know why that's the case, or why there's that feeling there from union leaders to not want to engage with the companies. But even more so, the workers feel even more powerless because some of these contracts, strip away their ability to organize and to, for instance, if they want to walk out, that's not something that they'd be able to do because of these union contracts and such. So there is kind of this distrust right now with the workers and some of these unions because it doesn't seem that they have any ability to be helping them in this situation. And, historically, haven't been able to truly address some of the longer and systemic issues that these workers have been addressing.
Thank you, Stephanie, do you want to comment on Tennessee?
Just quickly. I mean, some plants here are union, some are not. But as far as the retaliation goes, I think, yes, workers are afraid that they'll be retaliated against for talking to their coworkers or organizing to change conditions, but even just sort of raising them, there's just a lot of fear given the extraordinarily high rates of unemployment and concerns about immigration status. And so we certainly see the need for more sort of clear and accessible and open ways for workers to file complaints.
Great. Thank you. And with that, thanks to each of our speakers. A special thank you to Mr. Guadalupe Paez and his daughter, to Dora Flores and Cristina Menortiz, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera, to Alejandro Murguia Ortiz, organizer in Iowa, and to Stephanie Teatro, Executive Director of the Tennessee Immigrants and Refugee Rights Coalition. For all of the media on the call, we will be making the recording available, as well as any of the speakers, if you want to have any follow-up interviews with them or other worker members, please let us know by contacting, I believe, media@nilc.org, media@nilc.org. And I think just in closing, as Christine mentioned, I think one of the things that we're seeing is the level of courage and leadership from workers like Guadalupe, Endora, and Alejandro's family and community members who are showing us that in a time of this historic public health crisis and economic crisis, that it is their leadership, that it is their courage, that they are putting their lives on the line for our collective health and well-being. We are urging all policymakers at the federal, state, and local level to understand that our collective well-being requires for everybody to have access to COVID-19 testing and medical care, as well as the economic and financial relief that everybody needs, and that we ensure that as a country, we do not let this unfettered, unbridled capitalism and corporate greed take a toll on our costs, on our health and well-being. So with that, thanks again to each of our speakers, and thanks to all of the reporters on the line. Thank you, operator.